Hello, I'm Eric Jansen. You're tuned to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. On tonight's Public Radio Party edition, lesbian pulp fiction, lesbian career girls, and Bruce Valanche. She was a young housewife with young children at home. And yes, I do mean married to a man. It was the late 1950s and early 60s. And she was a successful paperback writer, a writer of lesbian love stories. Scorned by the literary elite then, pulp fiction written by her and other authors, male and female, helped build the gay rights movement. Reading them now gives us an historical glimpse into gay and lesbian life in those times. Her name is Anne Bannon, and she's one of our guests tonight. She joins us from the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Anne Bannon, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you, Eric. It's very nice to be here.
My other live guest this evening is a film and culture critic and also an author. She just finished the fourth book in her Lesbian Career Girls series, spoofs of 1960s high school girls' career primers that humorously pay homage to lesbian pulp fiction like Anne's from the last century. Monica Nolan is here with me in KLW's San Francisco studios. Welcome, Monica.
Thanks, Eric. Happy to be here.
So stick around for an exploration of the changes in societal norms and LGBT rights over the years and the lasting legacy and influence of gay and lesbian pulp fiction. Later in the hour, we'll hear from comedy writer and actor Bruce Valanche, now starring in 42nd Street Moon's production of the 1939 musical Du Barry Was a Lady in this special hour-long edition of Out in the Bay. We'll start with Anne Bannon. Anne, where were you in your life when you started writing lesbian love novels, and what led you to start writing them?
Well, I was very stuck in a very stodgy marriage that turned out on retrospect to have been a very bad mistake, except for two beautiful children. But I kind of sensed even then that I was going to be foreclosed from opportunities to meet other women and to connect with them. And so I think what I really did was sit down and I wrote these books to invent the life that I couldn't live in the real world. And it brought me a lot of friendships. It brought me an immense amount of mail from women all over the country, even some men, because a great many men read these books. It was a creative outlet at a time in my life that was pretty bleak in a lot of other respects. I had no notion that the books would have a life of any kind beyond what was ordinarily expected for that kind of ephemeral literature. My fellow writers were people like Ray Bradbury and Gore Vidal and Mickey Spillane, and they were so outstandingly wonderful that their stuff, of course, had a life beyond that of the pulp paperbacks in which some of them were originally published. They were really thought of the way a magazine is thought of. You picked it up, you enjoyed it. It was very temporal. It was tied to the month or two in which it came out. You picked it up to read it on your commute to work, and then you threw it away. And I think that's how many people treated pulp fiction. So you really had no hope of ever being reviewed in the New York Times or the Saturday Review or any of the other going concerns that took a serious interest in books.
So it wasn't considered serious literature. Yeah.
No, it wasn't. And some of it, well, you know, rightly was viewed as just sleaze for a great many reasons, including the very lively and very suggestive covers. The cover artists were brilliant and funny, and there were all kinds of clever visual jokes, but they were, frankly, sleazy covers, and
right.
The books were slapped together with glue. You know, it was not a quality production. But you could still, you know, you could make a lot of money with them.
Where did the term pulp fiction come from, and is that a pejorative term?
Well, it has become a pejorative term. It's kind of an umbrella term for any writing like the, for example, the penny dreadfuls of the 19th century that are now back on people's minds because of a new television series. The penny dreadfuls were very similar. They were pitched to grand general audience, a kind of lowest common denominator, and the pulp fiction novels were as well. The term pulp comes from the very cheap, crappy paper, which is hardly much more than wood pulp,
right,
held together with glue, and so thin that they would print on one side and the ink would bleed through into the print on the other. And so people would pick them up, and by opening the book, you would often crack or snap the spine.
Yes.
So they, you know, physically they didn't have a durable life. But I have to say, they were cherished, they were saved, they were tucked under mattresses, they were tucked behind people's dressers and the shoes in the closet to be taken out and savored over and over again, because there had never been anything like that publishing phenomenon of books about young gay men and women available everywhere, on the newsstands, at the bus stop, in the drugstores, the airports. They were everywhere that magazines were sold. And if you were young and gay in the 1950s, just to be able to reach out and read about people who were somehow getting through their lives, finding partners, finding ways to continue to enjoy life and to laugh every now and then, despite some grim endings, it was life-saving, literally, for many people.
And I want you to, you know, to give folks a flavor of what we're talking about. You've selected a couple of passages to read, and I'm hoping you can read. And you said, you said it does not too racy. And so far, from what I've read of your books, and I did read all of Bebo Brinker, and I've started Odd Girl out, but I haven't gotten. If you said there's, you're going to read the first sex scene between Laura and Beth, and I haven't gotten there yet. So it's okay. I can handle that. It's going to be, you know, you're going to bring me ahead a little farther than I am right now.
Okay. Well, would you like me to read that one first?
Yes, that would be great.
Okay. Beth and Laura are two young women who are sorority sisters. Beth is the elder of the two, a dark-haired beauty and kind of a campus leader. Laura is young, very unsecure, doesn't really know herself, and has never been able to face up to her feelings. But she is deeply attracted to Beth. Beth is a little cavalier with her, but she's attracted too. So they're sharing a room. They're on a day bed in their shared room in their sorority house. And this is the beginning of physical contact between the two of them. Beth murmured as Laura's hands began to trace the curves of her back. Oh, that's marvelous. She shivered a little, and Laura trembled with her. Under my pajamas, Laura. Warily, Laura lifted the pajama shirt and groped for the ripe, smooth warmth beneath. Oh, yes, Beth sighed. And Laura's hands descended to their enthralling task again, caressing the flawless hollows, the sweet shoulders. She was lost to reason now. She parted the hair that hid Beth's neck and drew her fingers lightly over the white nape. She leaned closer, hardly aware that she moved. With a swift thrill of necessity, she bent and kissed the softness for a long moment. Then sudden fear pulled her up. She put her hand up to her mouth and stared in terror at Beth. Beth lay perfectly still, a faint smile on her lips. "Beth," said Laura. "Beth?" The whisper quailed. "Oh, Beth, say something. Forgive me. Say something. Are you mad at me?" Beth whispered softly, "No." A wash of heat flooded Laura's face. She bent over Beth and began to kiss her like a wild, hungry child, pausing only to murmur, "Beth, Beth, Beth." Beth rolled over on her back and looked up at Laura, reaching for her, breathing hard and smiling a little, and her excitement consumed the last of Laura's reserve. Her lips found Beth's and found them welcoming.
You know, actually, I did read that, because actually that's at the very beginning. It's like the prologue, isn't it?
It sort of is, and I will tell you that you have to be 22 to write like that.
Without any dirty words.
No,
or words. I shouldn't say dirty words, but words we're not supposed to say on public radio.
Very true, which I will forbear to say.
Okay, so I think this is the moment I need to bring Monica Nolan into the conversation now because, first of all, I'll just mention, Monica has written four books so far in her Lesbian Career Girls series. Lois Lenz, Lesbian Secretary, Bobby Blanchard, Lesbian Gym Teacher, Maxie Mainwaring, Lesbian Dilettante, and due out this fall, Dolly Dingell, Lesbian Landlady. She's going to read for us as well, but I want to read a little bit from Monica's blog, Pulp and Pep, which you can find at MonicaNolan.com. She says, it was the NIAID edition of Journey to a Woman, one of Anne Bannon's book, that introduced me not only to Anne Bannon, but also to the world of lesbian pulp. The 70s feminist cover I saw when I pulled the book off the shelf of my dorm common room in 1985 did not prepare me for the heavy breathing soap opera I found inside, a style so foreign to our irony-heavy 80s sensibility that my friends and I passed it around, reading bits aloud, snorting with laughter. Snorting with laughter, yes, but unable to stop reading until we'd followed the story through increasingly over the top twists to its happy conclusion. I read the other books in the series and even made a film inspired by them, but it's only after diving into the world of lesbian pulp that I realized how groundbreaking Bannon really was. So there's kudos to you, Anne, but also just the whole dorm room setting of Laura and Beth.
So, it's so great. It's got everything. It's the sorority girls. It's the massage that turns into something more.
I remember that in my life.
And it's also, you know, what I love about your books, Anne, is that there's a really modern edge to them because it's Beth in that scene is actually, you know, could be a contemporary supposedly straight girl experimenting. It's got that going on, too.
Well, you have been very generous to those books, Monica. And
it's such a thrill to hear you read them. I was just listening to you. It's so funny to hear your voice reading the words that I've read so many times. It's great.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you have carried the tradition on with great brilliance. I'm very proud of your work.
I have my share of ripe flesh. It's true.
So tell us then, how did these books help the gay community? You know, this is, in the case of your books, Anne, it was before Stonewall, before the Compton Cafeteria riots. You talked a little bit about it, how this helped individuals, like, sort of find each other and realize there are other people like them out there. Are there other ways in which they, you know, helped galvanize?
Well, I think so. I think without meaning to, we kind of were the beginning of a foundation or a launch pad for all the wonderful work that was to follow. We were doing this, most of us, in the 50s to the mid-60s, and I think it gave a lot of courage and momentum to young gay people of that era. Remember, the Stonewall Rebellion came along in 1969 and became a place where the public generally could see what a tremendous amount of guts and determination there was in a community that had been scorned for decades, for centuries, really. And suddenly their stories were being told, and their stories were touching and inspirational, a little over the top, I grant you that, but reflecting back to themselves in a kind of mirror, the lives they were living every day. So at the time they came out, they served as a kind of refuge and a confirmation of real lives. And in the years since then, I think they are not only a type of social history, but, you know, Monica put her finger on this a little bit. They I think, capture what it's like to be young, uncertain of yourself, perhaps facing a lot of opprobrium and rejection, and finding that core of strength in yourself to face up, to come out, and to live your life. And knowing that young people were doing it half a century ago and doing it successfully, adds to the, I think, the fiber of the experience and sustains your determination. So, yes, sure, they provided a sort of travel guide, a cook's tour of Greenwich Village at the time they were new. And it's fun to go back and reconstruct that kind of magical place, like the Castro is a magical place. But it was so much more than that. I think it was confirming to the astonishment of so many people, straight and gay, that gay people were living next door. They were living under your roof. They were your uncle or your kid or your spouse, the people you worked with. And they were just as sensible, thoughtful, creative, honorable people as everybody else. And everyone had thought of them as these carriers of a disease for so many decades, and no one had ever really gotten to know who they were as human beings. So I think that was part of that foundation, that launch pad that we constructed as our contribution, one of many, but an important one.
Well, and I think you also put it really well, Anne, because you said you were inventing the life you wanted to lead. And I think that's what those books did for a lot of people. They invented the life. You have to imagine what that life, you know, what a gay lesbian community is going to look like. And you have to sort of invent it in your head before you can make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's very true. I think what ultimately those books became were, in the aggregate, they were my love letter to the women I would never know, the women whose lives I would never be able to share. I think they were warm, ultimately, despite some very lively histrionics in them, but warm and accepting and in places even humorous and affirming. So if I'm not wrong in that, then that was very helpful to a lot of women.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. My name is Eric Jansen. My guests are Anne Bannon, who's in Sacramento at the Capitol Public Radio Studios. She's written was the author of a series of lesbian pulp fiction novels in the 50s and 60s, and Monica Nolan here with me, who's written the Lesbian Career Girls series. And I wanted to ask you what you think might have happened if people beyond your close circle knew, or did they know, about the books that you were writing at that time when you were married and young. And where were you living then? Were you in Sacramento already, or were you in the Midwest?
No. We were down in Southern California. Oh. And, in a little town called Sierra Madre. And I was very, very much a young mother with little kids hanging onto my knees and a very cranky husband. life was rather circumscribed. There were some exciting moments. They really, my publisher very much wanted to get some of the books onto film. And he was an old movie guy. He was an old Hollywood script writer. And he would come out to Los Angeles and sell some of the books. It was Gold Medal Publications, and his name was Dick Carroll. He knew everybody in Hollywood, and I went to Bel Air Hotel on several occasions and the Beverly Hills and met some very interesting people. They were talking about making a movie with Sal Mineo, but it was too scary. You couldn't be a public gay person back then. You forfeited too much. You were classified as someone with a psychological disorder, and you were thought of as contagious. So that part was very difficult. And for that reason, I, in my private life, was really very reticent. A few members of my family knew what I was doing, including my mother, who was very gracious about it. But she, of course, had proudly told all her friends, Anne is writing a book. So when it came out, you can imagine, we want to read it. And Mother had to say, I'm sorry, I I know she'll do better in the future, but this is not the book.
And then eventually you went into the academic life.
Oh, yes, I did. I redeemed myself in her eyes, but her main injunction was, do not show this to your grandmother. And I was very cautious about that. So not many people knew. But I can tell you that by the middle of my academic career, I was still a faculty member here at Sacramento State. People began to know about the books because a new edition was brought out by NIAID Press and also by the New York Times, of all people, in hard covers. I finally made a respectable publisher. And so our library knew about them and had a full set of the books. People around campus would come up and talk to me about them. I thought maybe I was in big trouble, but people were exceedingly gracious and really, it was enough of a different time so that I found that it was well accepted. The books were thought to be interesting and fun, and I really never had to suffer consequences for it. So I remain very grateful to the institution for that, and yeah, I think it's a measure of even by that time how far things had improved. Not that we ever, you know, think we're satisfied, but even then you could see what direction things were trending.
So, Monica, I want to ask you how Anne's Pulp Fiction and that by other writers inform the writing that you do now in your Lesbian Career Girl series.
Well, the Lesbian Career Girl series is completely inspired by the Pulp Fiction of the late 50s and early 60s. So I think I try to take a lot of the same situations and twist them around a little bit. So I use the all female environment. I don't have a sorority house, but I have a boarding house that's girls, mm-hmm. women only boarding house. And I have bathroom encounters, and I really do need a massage scene.
And well, you've got the shower scene.
I have
a
shower
scene.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could read that one right now.
Sure.
And this is from. We're starting at the beginning. This is the opening scene, is it not, in the first of your series, Lois Lenz, Lesbian Secretary?
Yeah, this is from Lois Lenz, Lesbian Secretary, and this is, I'm not sure how much of an introduction I need to do. This is the very opening chapter. It takes place in a high school, in the high school gymnasium locker room. Steam filled the empty locker room, drifting over the white sinks and rows of green lockers like mist rolling in from the ocean. Drops of water formed on the underside of the long benches where the girls sat to change out of their gym uniforms and dripped onto the gray and green tiled floor. The steam wrapped around Lois Lenz like a damp towel as she stood just outside the shower stall. Her brassiere dangled forgotten from one hand as she gazed at her best friend, Faye. The steam blurred the outlines of Faye Collins's slender, athletic body as she turned slowly this way and that under the spray, luxuriating in the hot water that pummeled her tender flesh. Lois's eyes devoured the white shoulders, the high breasts, the pouting mouth. That mouth, she thought, that pink, glistening mouth. "Your lipstick, is it that new kiss-proof kind?" murmured Lois huskily. "Yes," Faye replied, flashing a tantalizing smile at Lois. "It's called strawberry ice." Suddenly, she uncoiled one soapy arm and reached out to the other girl. "Come and try it," she whispered, pulling Lois under the spray. "It's not really my color," Lois managed to gasp before she surrendered to Faye's embrace. The feel of her friend's satin skin against her own bare flesh, the touch of Faye's tongue on her own, set a fire burning inside Lois that no shower could put out. A moan escaped her when Faye's supple fingers trailed down the small of her back. The steady rush of water all but covered the faint sound. Still, Faye stopped what she was doing to hiss, "Lois." "Sorry," muttered Lois, wrapping her arms around the other girl. She covered Faye's mouth with her own, silencing any further protest.
Well, on that note, I think it's a good time to let our listeners know that these books are available as thank you gifts for becoming a member of KALW during our public radio party. And we also, I just found out right before I went on the air, that we have a challenge from listeners Richard Merck and Brad Payton in Portola Valley. And they are big supporters of both Out in the Bay and This Way Out, which is not being heard tonight because we're doing a full hour, but usually This Way Out follows Out in the Bay. They've put up $500 to get five new members during this hour. So if you've been listening and have never been a member or a lapsed member of KALW, please call 1-800-525-9917 or go online to kalw.org and become a member at any level from $10 to $1,000, whatever is comfortable for you. And Richard and Brad will chip in $100 per new member, up to $500. So that's one thing. And then these books, for the basic, our basic membership level is $50, but for a mere $10 more, you can get either Maxie Mainwaring, Lesbian Dilettante by Monica Nolan, or Odd Girl Out by Ann Bannon. And if you want to pony up $200, you will get the full four-book series issued by Cleus Press of the Ann Bannon Bebo Brinko series. It's Odd Girl Out, I Am a Woman, Women in the Shadows, and Bebo Brinker. We're going to hear a selection from Bebo Brinker soon, I believe. Or you can get, and there's only one of these available, so you have to phone for this one. It's not available online. Three books by Monica Nolan. The Monica Nolan box set, Lois Lenz, Lesbian Secretary, Maxie Mainwaring, Lesbian Dilettante, and Bobby Blanchard, Lesbian Gym Teacher, because there's only a few copies of Lois Lenz left.
Yeah, it's not in print. It's, you can get it as an e-book, but they haven't reprinted it.
So if you're interested in that, by all means, please give a call, 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. Or you can go online to kalw.org for the single books. Or anything else you would like to donate, become a new member, and meet that challenge put up by Richard Merck and Brad Payton. Thank you so much. So now let's I want to ask you a little bit more, Monica, about Maxie Mainwaring, Lesbian Dilettante. It's, in my opinion, it seems like it's more serious. It has more references to social and political forces at the time. You know, police raids on lesbian and gay bars. One of the characters is writing for a lesbian magazine or newsletter like The Ladder that Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin started here in San Francisco. And I'm curious about that change in tone. Or is that, you know, is that my imagination or is that?
No, that's not your imagination. It's partly because the books are moving forward in time. So Lois Lenz takes place in 1959 and there are overlapping characters and they're, it's all centered around Bay City for the most part, where the girls live. But by the time we get to Maxie Mainwaring, it's 1964, which, of course, was Freedom Summer. That's on my mind because I just saw a documentary about it. So it was, it was a time of unrest. And I think that social change was in the air, and I wanted to reflect that in the book.
And Anne, we had talked on the phone about this, you know, the raids. Since we were talking about raids on bars, lesbian and gay bars, your book has this very good description of Greenwich Village at the time. And by the way, I'm curious to know, did you spend a lot of time? Did you live in Greenwich Village or did you just go there for research? Or,
oh, I wish I could have. Yeah, I was there in spirit. I was there physically as much as I could be. For a while, when I first began to write, we did live in Philadelphia, and it wasn't hard to get up to the village by train. But after I wrote Odd Girl Out, we moved to Southern California. But even then, I was able to fly back on several occasions. And I just loved it. I walked all over the village. I went to all the bars. I would walk home utterly fearless out of sheer stupidity. At 4 a.m, I'd walk through Washington Square. And I never feared man nor beast, which I should have. But it was an innocent time, I think.
Well, now, but you've got it. There's a scene from the that we talked about. You reading the dance bar scene where Bebo Brinker first goes out. She's newly arrived from the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Sounded kind of like you. I wasn't sure since you grew up in Illinois. She meets this guy Jack who takes her up off the street, and you know he's this gay guy who's sort of takes her under his wing, and she finally gets the nerve to go to this one dance bar. or a bar where women mm-hmm. dance anyway. And can you mm-hmm. can you read part of that scene?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Bebo is going out a little bit of nightclub hopping all on her own for the first time without her friend Jack along as a chaperone. And so the girls in the bar have sort of become acquainted with her, and she's quite a striking figure. She's tall, very strongly built, handsome girl, and but very kind of solitary, and they don't quite know what to make of her or how to approach her. So that's what this little scene is about. She took a seat at the bar. "Scotch and water," she said. While the barman got it, she gazed idly into the mirror behind him, picking out the interesting girls surrounding her. She felt uncomfortable here in the pants she usually wore to work, in her hair that had just been cut and was too short again. The bartender brought her another drink while she searched for the last cigarette in her pack. It was empty. The girl sitting next to her immediately offered her one, but Bebo declined. It was partly her shyness, partly the knowledge that it was better to be hard to get in the Colophon bar. "Do you have cigarettes?" she asked the bartender. "Machine by the wall," he said. She got up and sauntered over, ignoring the outrage on the face of the girl at the bar. The machine swallowed her coins and spit out a pack of filter tips. Bebo noticed the jukebox, looked at her change, and fed it a quarter, good for three dances. She liked to watch the girls move around the floor together, now that the initial revolt had worn off. But when she regained her seat, she found most of the patrons paying attention to her, not the tunes. She looked back at them, surprised and wary. The cigarettes in her hand were an excuse to look away for a minute, and she did, lighting one while the general conversation died away like a weak breeze. She lowered her match slowly and glanced up again, her skin prickling. What were they trying to do? Scare her out? Show her they didn't like her? Had she been too aloof with them? Too remote and hard to know? She had started the music, and it was an invitation to dance. They were waiting for her to show them. It wasn't hostility she saw in their faces so much as, "Show us if you're so damn big and smart. We've been waiting for a chance to trap you. This is it." She had to do something to humanize herself. There was an air of self-confidence and sensual promise about Bebo that she couldn't help, and when she felt neither confident nor sensual, she looked all the more as if she did, tall and strong and coolly sure of herself. She had turned the drawback of being young and ignorant into a deliberate defense. It didn't matter to the sophisticated girls judging her now that she was a country girl, fresh from the hayfields of Wisconsin, or that she had never made love to a woman before in her life. They didn't know that, and wouldn't have believed it anyway. Bebo recognized quickly that she had to start acting the way she looked. She had established a mood of expectation about herself, and now it was time to come across. The music played on. It was Bebo's turn. The match she held was burning near her finger, and because she had to do something about it, and all the eyes on her, she turned to the girl beside her and held out the match. "Blow," she said simply, and the girl, with a smile, blew.
That's great. Well, speaking of blowing, I think that's a good time to turn to gay male pulp.
Oh yeah,
you know a little bit about it. I mean, neither of you wrote it, but Monica, you've written about it on your blog and this panel that you had last fall where I met Anne at the San Francisco Library. This guy Victor Banas apparently wrote a whole lot of stuff and actually first got arrested for writing a lesbian novel, right?
Right. Yeah, which I have yet to read. I'm kind of eager to check that one out. And Anne, you know Victor Banas, right?
Oh, yes, very well. Victor is a lovely guy. And he wrote as Don Halliday. He wrote The Why Not.
The Why Not was the groundbreaking one.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they came along later, right? And do you suppose why that is? And do you get the sense that they had the same sort of impact, or was it a very different thing in some way?
I think it was... I'm sorry. Go ahead, Anne.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just it's funny because I've just been reading a book that's sort of an anthology of critical essays about gay male pulp. And I think it came along later. It was a bit of a different thing. One of the things that's interesting about it is it was a heck of a lot raunchier, I think, from the start, the mid-60s stuff at least. And the gay male writers had, I think, a little more of an outlet in sort of literary publishing. You had Gore Vidal and other people like that who were able to get things published, where I think lesbians had less. So I think the gay male pulps had served a different function for the community. And also, which also is one of the reasons that they're sort of only coming into their own now. They're sort of getting the sort of recuperation that happened to lesbian pulps a little while ago. But I think am I right about that, Anne, that they were a lot sexier, that there was sort of more sex happening in the gay male pulps?
Yes, I think they were much more candid about it.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that, they had a tougher time getting some traction. One great advantage of the lesbian pulps was that they appealed enormously to men.
Absolutely.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, that's a question I was wondering. Yeah. How do you get a sense of who your audience was? Do you get a sense of how many men were buying your books as opposed to women? And by the way, Monica did confess to me earlier that she actually enjoys, or I don't know if you enjoy it, but you read straight porn for inspiration in some
porn?
Ways, ideas? Erotica. I'm sorry. Erotica. Erotica.
Don't make me worse than I am, Eric. I do. No, I read everything. But I do think that gay male pulps had a harder time. And maybe that's mm-hmm. in a way that they were more strictly for a gay male audience than lesbian pulps were, where there was that overlap. And yeah, Anne, did you get letters ever from men?
Oh, yes. Oh, I got many letters. That they found it very arousing and fun. Some of them, well, you know, I think I mentioned this at the panel last fall. There is graffiti on the walls of caves in Norway that was put there over 1,000 years ago, referring to the girls in the next cave. If you want a wonderful night, you know, or as you approached many of the cities in ancient Greece, there would be posts along the way inviting you to particular kinds of brothels where there were ladies to be seen together.
Right.
I think it really, but this is an ancient fascination on the part of many men, mostly straight,
yeah.
whereas the men had yet to find their crossover audience. It
sure.
was there, but they didn't know how to appeal to it, and it began to surface, I think, when Star Trek first came out on
right.
television.
Yeah.
How so?
And women have been writing, fanzine articles
sure.
about Mr. Spock and Captain Kirk for a long time. And
yeah.
that kind
and
of
that's,
well,
I just made saw,
people...
Somebody just showed me a video about that a while ago.
Well, and that's also, mm-hmm. that's like a big, there's a large number of straight women writing gay male romance today, which still I
yes.
find a fascinating fact.
Huh.
Kind
yes.
of inspiring, kind of just boggling my mind. But yeah,
I would have to say it's different from the original gay male pulps.
Yeah,
but it has found a much broader audience of both men and women. So you know, there's something for everyone. But I think the guys had a longer, steeper
right.
hill to climb to find their audience, and it was mainly originally confined to other young men or other gay
right.
men.
And you know, that's an interesting thing. One of the fascinating things I read in this book is that the publishers of that time, you know, the sleazy paperback publishers who were putting out the gay male pulps, and this is, again, a little later than the lesbian pulps. We're talking the mid-60s. Mm-hmm. Some of the writers were complaining about the fact that they were basically required to have a sex scene in every chapter. I mean, that's really, and they wanted, you know, they were more interested in doing narratives, you know, doing narrative stuff, telling the story. And they were like, and which I think is so ironic, because the thing you get with the lesbian pulps is that, you know, they were required not to have a happy ending, whereas the men had to just put as much sex in as they could.
Hey, we're almost out of time. I'm sorry about that. But I want to give a chance for you to read. Do you have a short selection, Monica, from Maxie Mainwaring that you had in mind by any chance?
Well, I was inspired by Anne and reading about Bebo to read a little bit about Lon, who's kind of the Bebo-like character in Maxie Mainwaring. She's sort of this mysterious, very masculine-looking girl who actually even passes as a boy at times. So I'll just read a brief part. This is Maxie, of course, is a down-on-her-luck heiress who's been disinherited by her mother. And so in this scene, she's visiting a pawn shop in an attempt to pawn a pearl necklace and get some cash. And Lon, who is maybe connected with the underworld, turns up there. Maxie turned, and there was Lon, lounging against an ancient armoire. Where on earth had she come from? The shop bell hadn't made a sound. Lon was wearing a striped polo shirt and faded Levi's, and her hair had gotten bleached by the sun, which had also freckled her nose. The all-American girl boy looked as out of place in the seedy shop as a birch bark canoe in an industrial canal. "Buy you a drink?" Lon held the door for Maxie and nodded at the pawnbroker. "See you, Pete." On the pavement, Maxie found her voice. "You were there all the time," she accused the handsome he-she. "Peddling stolen goods?" Maybe that's why the pawnbroker hadn't been interested in her pearls. He was a fence. Lon smiled. "Pete does some appraising for me." Maxie wasn't sure if that meant she was right or if Lon was kidding her. It was just so darn difficult to believe someone so clean-cut could actually be knee-deep in dirt. Lon guided the suspicious girl into a dim bar down the street, and they slid into a corner booth. The man at the bar looked them over and then turned back to the television overhead. Maxie realized with a start that she and Lon were being taken for a boy-girl couple. She felt offended, then uneasy, and finally rather deliciously naughty. "So you need money," said Lon, playing with a toothpick. The waiter came by to take their order, and Maxie asked for a martini, hoping it wouldn't fog her mind too much when she got back to work. Lon ordered a beer. "Be careful. He might ask to see your driver's license," Maxie said. "What does it say, anyway?" So then Lon shows her driver's license, which has the name Yolanda Laney, and Maxie is all scared that Lon's going to get exposed as a girl. Lon laughed as she pocketed her wallet. "Scared? I thought you were Madcap Maxie, who lived for thrills." "Who's been telling you about me?" Maxie demanded. "Anyway, I'm not afraid. You're the one who'll get it in the neck if you're careless. I can just pretend I was taken in, too." "You wouldn't do that. They said madcap, not mean." Lon slid over so that she was right next to Maxie. She put her hand on the back of Maxie's neck and her lips on Maxie's. Maxie went still with shock, feeling the velvety stimulus through a layer of disbelief. Then, like a frostbitten pioneer rubbing snow on her frozen feet, sensation began to flow, a tingling that was half pleasure, half pain. As Lon's hand twisted in her hair, a shiver went through the temporary receptionist, and her initial coldness was completely cured.
Thank you so much. That's Monica Nolan, author of Maxie Mainwaring, Lesbian Dilettante. Just reading a section from that. And Anne Bannon, author of Odd Girl Out and four other lesbian romance novels, a pulp fiction in the 1950s and 60s. I want to thank you so much both for being here.
Thank you, Eric.
And thank you, Eric. It was a pleasure.
Yeah.
Likewise. And I want to remind folks that these books by these authors are available as thank you gifts for new members, or any members, anybody who wants to chip up $60 to KLW to support local public radio, $60 for Odd Girl Out, and or $60 for Maxie Mainwaring, Lesbian Dilettante. You can get those online at kalw.org or by phoning 800-525-9917. We also have a new member challenge put up by Richard Merck and Brad Payton in Portola Valley. So please, if you're a new member, call or click and take advantage of that. KALW.org or online or phoning 800-525-9917. Also, a limited edition by telephone only. Monica Nolan box set, all three books in the Lesbian Career Girl series, or also for Ann Bannon Bebo Brinker series. Those are also available by phone only, 800-525-9917. Thank you so much. And now we are going to have a little interview with Bruce Valanche. I'm very happy to welcome to Out in the Bay's studios here at KALW, Bruce Valanche. Among the earliest openly gay comics and an award-winning comedy writer, he's known for his continuing role on Hollywood Squares and as a head writer for the Academy Awards show. He's written 23 of them so far, I guess. He's also written for Bette Midler, Elizabeth Taylor, The Brady Bunch, Donnie and Marie, Lily Tomlin. And he's appeared as a comedy actor many times, perhaps most notably, or most memorably for me anyway, as Edna Turnblad, Tracy's mother in the Broadway and touring theatrical version of Hairspray, which played here in San Francisco a few years back. I'm not quite sure how long ago was that. Bruce, do you know?
Ooh, almost 10 years ago.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
2004.
Okay. Yeah, that's 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was 10 years ago. Oh, my God.
Bruce.
Excuse me, I must lie down.
Bruce Valanche is back in San Francisco, appearing in 42nd Street Moon's current production of Du Barry Was a Lady, a musical featuring lyrics by Cole Porter. 42nd Street Moon specializes in musical theater. And Bruce, you know, I'm curious to know, an actor of your, an entertainer of your national and international stature, here you are performing with a small, well-respected, but small regional theater company. What drew you to this role in this production?
Well, it was written for Bert Lahr, and I always was mad for Bert Lahr, and I've looked like the Cowardly Lion for years, and I thought I should cash that chip already. Because it's a great old-school kind of musical that they don't write much anymore, and that anybody was doing it was thrilling to me because I just wanted the opportunity to exercise that muscle. And I'd seen a couple of things at the Moon, and I thought, this is fun. They do a postage stamp production of these great big Broadway shows of yore. And I thought it would be fun to kind of just give it a twirl, see what it was like. And, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being in San Francisco for 6 weeks. That's fantastic.
You live in Los Angeles now, but you seem to like to come up here a lot.
I come up here all the time.
You were in the big gay comedy. You were the MC of the big gay comedy show about a month ago.
I did. Well, I do a lot of stuff for Richmond Remembered Foundation because they're a fantastic AIDS organization. And the money is well spent. So I usually do a couple of benefits for them a year. So I'm up here a lot for one thing or another. You know, people from L.A. do come up here for a shot of city.
It's hard. It's nice to know that.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and are you a particular fan of doing musicals or Cole Porter specifically?
Well, I'm mad about Cole Porter. And in my own act, when I do music, I try and find some songs of his because the lyrics are so witty. They're just so clever. And a lot of benefits I've done, Let's Do It. Because, you know, birds do it, bees do it, because you can rewrite that stuff. His estate doesn't seem to mind if you rewrite stuff for a specific occasion. He did it himself, actually, for some different things. So I always try to do something of his, and he's amazing. And, I've toyed around since Hairspray with doing other musicals, and nothing has really worked out. But when I heard they were doing this, I called them up and said, could I be in it? Because no one else is going to do this show. And it's so funny. It's a burlesque and old school. You get to make faces and carry on and be over the top. And, you know, it's kind of like the dog being let out of the garage.
Well, it is kind of outrageous. I mean, this whole thing, the whole story is this crazy dream sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of briefly tell us the storyline?
Well, it's 1939, and there's a very fancy French nightclub in New York, a faux, you know, fake French nightclub. And Louis Blore is the men's room attendant in the nightclub, and he wins the Irish sweepstakes, which was like winning the lottery. And everybody wants money from him, and one thing leads to another, and he gets a Mickey Finn, which is like a roofie, but without the sexual component. And while he's out, because he's been given this drug,
he intended for his rival,
for his rival, his romantic rival. When he's out, he has a dream where he's Louis the 15th of France. He has this dream because he has just come from the movies, where he saw a movie about Louis the 15th and Madame du Barry. And so, in his dream, everybody in his life is cast in this fantasy in which he's Louis the 15th. And he comes out of it by the end of the show and realizes that the money he's won from the sweepstakes isn't worth all the aggravation that it's caused, and that he has to go back to the men's room and be his authentic self.
And that's when one of the songs that we're going to play a little bit of comes, so people know Cole Porter's music.
Right.
At the very end of the song, he realizes friends are important, so perhaps the most famous, Friendship.
Friendship.
If you're ever in a gem, here I am.
If you ever need a pal, I'm your gal.
If you ever feel so happy you land in jail, I'm your bail.
It's friendship, friendship, just a perfect friendship. When other friendships have been forgot, ours will still be hot. Love, 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 ding, ding, ding.
Now, I should know who that is, but I don't, because David LaTulipa, he queued that up, and he knows musical theater better than I do. Thanks for engineering,
he's
David.
Well, that's Bert Lahr, who was the Cowardly Lion.
The original.
The original. This is actually from a television special in 1954 with Ethel Merman, the distinctive voice of Ethel Merman. And they had done it originally on Broadway in 39, and then they came back to do an hour version of Anything Goes, in which this song had been interpolated years later. And most people think that it was done by Lucy and Ethel on I Love Lucy, because Lucille Ball did the movie of Drew Barry Was a Lady, and she took the song and she put it into I Love Lucy.
Uh-huh.
And so younger people know it instantly from Lucy and Ethel Go to the Talent Show. But it was the original thing, and these are the original stars who did it.
So I saw the play last night, and I was kind of surprised at some of the other lyrics from Cole Porter, like... but in the morning, no. And there's all these, talks about swimming, and there's like, in the breaststroke, yes, I'll do the breaststroke, but in the morning,
riding
no.
and shooting, and...
And then accounting.
The accounting stuff.
Double entry, yes, I'll do double entry, but in the morning, no.
How often
no.
do you hear an accounting joke?
How did he get away with that?
Well,
those days?
It was a total double entendre. You know, it was 1939, and it was innocent. The lyrics were innocent on the face of it, but of course, the audience knew what they meant. When they went to Boston to try the show out, they got into trouble. And they had to change it. But then when they went, that got them a lot of publicity. And when they got to New York, the lyrics were reverted to the original double entendre lyrics. And of course, the New York Times didn't like that. They said the show was full of obscenity. But it was a hit, off of these two personalities and off of Betty Grable, who was the soubrette, the ingenue lead in the show. And she, this was her springboard to Hollywood fame.
And now you can see that you can hear these words for yourself if you go to
the Eureka Theater.
42nd Street Moon at the Eureka Theater. Drew Barry Was a Lady, starring Bruce Valanche, and a cast of wonderful actors and actresses
they're
and dancers. Great dancers.
And they're all, young. They're all...
Energetic.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the Von Trapp children. I mean, they're not that young. But they're, young and fabulous musical comedy kids, who can do everything. Sing, tap dance... Do jokes there, and it looks like it's a little production of a big Broadway show, and it looks quite lavish considering.
Any more plans for more shows at 42nd Street? I noticed that next season they'll be doing Cole Porter's Something for the Boys, and
that was Ethel Merman vehicle.
Now, that was
the boys were fighting men. It was a World War II show, and that was a big Merman vehicle. So maybe Ashley Ray Little, who's playing the Merman part in this show, will get to do that because she's really good. She can do more than Ethel did. I mean, I worked with Ethel Merman as a writer. I was a child actor with her, and then I worked with her as a writer on television shows. And Ethel would stand there and sing. And she could move. She'd move around. But she wasn't the kind of dancer that this girl is.
It's kind of amazing. She's singing these guys are holding her up in the air.
Oh,
and she's on her side.
I mean,
and she's finishing a number. That was pretty fantastic.
Not the Merm.
I should know her name, but I don't have it handy.
Ashley Ray Little.
Thank you very much. Ashley Ray Little. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Go see it. I want to ask you about changes you've seen for gay and lesbian actors and roles in Hollywood over the years. But before we do that, I want to just do one more thing, because you're a man of so many talents, not just an actor, dancer, comedian, comic writer, but also a songwriter. So I found something from one of your friends. At least you call it that in your program notes. Let's hear it.
richly deserve. A man who knows what I require has the thing that I desire. Is there anyone out there who has the nerve?
Wow, that's Eartha Kitt singing a song that my guest wrote. Bruce Valanche, Where's My Man?
Where is my man? Where is my man? That's what I want to know.
It's in your program notes.
I came to San Francisco, and I'm asking the question.
Found a man.
Where is my man?
He's single, guys. Come on. Come on down to the playhouse
really
and see him.
Show up.
So did you write that specifically for Eartha Kitt?
I did, actually. I had written the first draft of one of the great bad movies of all time called Can't Stop the Music. It was the Village People musical. And I quit after the first draft, and others came in and committed the film itself. But Jacques Morali, who was the Village, created the Village People, had another gig. He had a show in Paris, the Crazy Horse Review, and he wrote for that every year, and so he asked me to come and write lyrics for him for the Crazy Horse show. And at the Crazy Horse, gorgeous girls would lip sync these songs that were recorded by famous artists. And so we wrote this song for a gorgeous girl to pretend she was Eartha Kitt.
Okay.
And the song got picked up by French radio, and it became a gigantic hit in Europe and all over the place. I mean, I have gold records from everywhere. Uh-huh. Every place but, the States where where Eartha was considered old and,
Well, when did she record that?
1983, okay. I think, something like that.
Because I'm thinking that
84.
Yeah. When I went to the just iTunes to download it, to find it and download it, the longer version was only available in the Ireland store. You couldn't even get it on the
really?
U.S. store.
Yeah,
but I found the short version, but not the long one.
It never had. I mean, you should pardon the expression, a 12-inch, which was the vinyl that they would give to DJs.
The EP.
And that sold quite well because it was played in discos all over the place.
You know, I do remember
when
it,
they were
sure.
still using vinyl.
Yeah, you're still getting royalties off of that?
Yeah.
Good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we wound up doing an album with Eartha, a whole album called Where Is My Man? Uh-huh. And that did really well all around the world. And the song brought Eartha back. I mean, mm-hmm. she had been sitting in Connecticut, not doing anything, and had come in and done this vocal. And then suddenly she was touring discos. She was showing up at discos, like Grace Jones at 3 o'clock in the morning, to crowds of tweakers. And suddenly Eartha would come out and start singing one of these disco songs.
Wow.
And it led in Europe. It led her to concerts and back into the theater. And she wound up her career doing a lot of London stage and Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So I just want to ask you what kind of changes you've seen over the years that you've been in the business in roles and characters, gay and lesbian characters, and gay and lesbian actors being able to be out in Hollywood. How's that
well,
changed?
Well, we're there pretty much. I mean, the only thing that's left is the superhero, the action hero. It's still as difficult for a gay actor to come out and then play James Bond or a character like that. That's the one thing left. But I think that won't be long because I always said that once you got major league sports figures coming out, then it would be the inevitable extension of that. So I'm patiently waiting. Of course, I also don't know who the actor would be who would he may not be famous yet. He may be around, but not well known.
Mm-hmm.
So otherwise, I think we are there. I mean, now the debate always is can a gay actor play a straight part and all that kind of boring stuff that I think has been discredited, and I think that people are now getting cast for what they can do. But certainly. They traditionally would say if they wanted a leading man, they would say, can he kiss the girl? And a lot of leading men who are, straight cannot kiss the girl. So
maybe the gay man can kiss him better.
Maybe that's entirely possible. The argument has always been if they know he's gay, will that make a difference? And I think it won't anymore.
Right. Right.
But it still comes down to that. So, it's not a democracy. It's a subjective decision. So.
Right. So there are some interesting film credits on your website, including Going Down and La La Land.
Yeah.
I think that sounds familiar. I think I might have seen that.
Going Down La La Land is an independent gay feature, and it's
as soon as he ends
this
segment, which is pretty soon, you can fade him down and all.
Kid who falls off the
turnip truck
goes to L.A. to become a star, and everything happens. It's like a women's prison picture. You know those movies where the innocent virginal young girl is arrested for pickpocketing, and she goes to prison, and she comes out a hardened lesbian criminal.
Of course, yes.
It's the same kind of thing. It's like he becomes a crystal meth addict. I mean, everything out. And it's shot in the style of like an Aaron Spelling TV movie from the 70s.
Gosh, I'm going to have to go see it again. I thought I'd seen it, but it sounds better now.
I play a pornmeister. I play Shishi LaRue. But I play a character based on Shishi LaRue. Shishi LaRue is a drag queen who became a big porn producer.
Right.
And this character is based on Shishi. And I'm only in it like for a couple of scenes. But it's very entertaining. And Judy Tenuta, who's one of my favorite comedians, is also in it, and it's, you know, it is what it is. It's independent gay features which are made for $1.50.
We have to fade that down just a little bit early because my interview with Monica Nolan and Ann Bannon went a little long. 42nd Street Moon has donated three pairs of tickets to see DuBarry Was a Lady, starring Bruce Vilanch, next Thursday, 7 o'clock at the Eureka Theater in San Francisco. For a donation to KLW of $175 for a pair of tickets, is available by phone only at 800-525-9917. Again, that's 800-525-9917 for a donation of $175, a pair of tickets to see Bruce Vilanch starring in DuBarry Was a Lady at 42nd Street Moon Theater. And there's still a challenge grant on the table, generously offered by Richard Merck and Brad Payton. And $100, they have put up $100 per new member, up to 5 members at any level. If joined for $10, they'll put up $100. They'll match at $100. So please call now is the time to join and show your support for KLW and for Out in the Bay. The number is 800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org. And